Hello there, it's Dr. Neil Buttery here, food historian and chef, and welcome to listeners both old and new to the British Food History Podcast. Today I'm talking with author and food historian Pen Vogler about her book Stuffed, A History of Good Food and Hard Times in Britain, which was published toward the end of last year, 2023. Before we begin, just a reminder of the upcoming Postbag edition at the end of the season. Your questions, comments, queries regarding anything that pops up in today's episode, or any episode so far for that matter, please let me know about them. Perhaps you've seen some general food history in the news, or you've got a food history question, ideas for future episodes, blog posts. Get in contact. Email me, neil@britishfoodhistory.com, or leave a comment beneath a post, or send me a DM on social media. I'm at Neil Buttery on Twitter and Blue Sky, and I'm Dr, that's Dr, underscore Neil, underscore Buttery on Instagram and Threads. Or, and this is the best place to get a chat going, I have to say, post on the British Food History Facebook discussion page, which is at facebook.com/groups/British Food History. I've got news which I'll keep for the end, except to say that the book manuscripts that I've been writing have now been handed in. So after a week or so of R&R, it'll all be back to normal. With more frequent episodes, blog posts will start returning, and I'll be on social media a lot more. Of course, the day after I handed in the second of the two manuscripts, I got a chest infection, which is why I sound a bit funny today. But anyway, let's talk about today's episode. Pen Vogler is a food historian and author, not just of Stuffed, but also Scoff, A History of Food and Class in Britain, and Dinner with Mr. Darcy and Dinner with Dickens. She's also edited Penguin's fantastic Great Food series. In today's episode, we discuss how precarious our food supply was and still is, the Enclosure Acts and their effect upon our food, identity and relationship with food, allotments, havercakes, adulteration and malnutrition, school dinners, and Hallowoolly's pumpkin pie, amongst many other things. I'll be back with information about this episode's Easter eggs for my £3 subscribers, plus the other news, like I say, but now, Stuffed with Pen Vogler. Welcome to the podcast, Pen. I'm very excited to have the chance to have a talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's going to be really fun.
Should be fun. There's lots of history in your book, Stuffed, A History of Good Food and Hard Times in Britain. I read it over Christmas. I enjoyed it immensely.
Thank you.
One thing, before I actually start talking about maybe some of the things discussed in the book, is that title, because it sort of hinges on a bit of a pun or a double entendre.
It does.
Because Stuffed very much has two different meanings. When you're sort of coming to lay out the thesis of the book, that's kind of your emphasis. Could you just tell us a little bit about sort of how and why you came to that sort of conclusion to approach British history and the history of food?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for kind of spotting the pun in it. It was interesting, actually, because I had written the book. I knew exactly what it was about, and just could not find a title for it anywhere.
I'm rubbish at titles.
Yes, it's terrible. This is so hard. Which is almost exactly what happened in my previous book, Scoff. And in both cases, the title just sort of came. But with Stuffed, it was my cousin, who's a very brilliant thinker and a very innovative person, and she just went, Stuffed. And it was so obviously the right title, because it means Stuffed has two meanings. It means it has your good meaning, you're pleasantly stuffed, you've had a Christmas dinner, you feel quite kind of happy and sort of sleepy, but all's right with the world. And then, of course, it has its bad meaning. It has the idea that you're stuffed, you have no options left, you have run out of road. And really what the book does is looks at the sort of the line that goes between those two. So we all want to be kind of pleasantly stuffed. We don't want to be sort of in, you know, economically or kind of domestically stuffed. But how do we get from one to the other? And if we are in a crisis, as an individual crisis or as a nation or as a kind of a people or a community, who is it? My question really was at the bottom of it, who takes responsibility for getting us out of that kind of, out of that hole? Who unstuffs us in a way? Who takes it on themselves? You know, is it an individual? Is it a government? Is it a corporation? And so really I was sort of tracing that idea through history and how that has changed.
Yes. And of course, in the West, we like to think we're free from the kind of bad side of being stuffed and we're in some kind of golden period. But one thing that you definitely show, and this is always what's great about doing any kind of history, is that you can learn a lot from history, and you can also learn that we're living in actually quite a precarious time, even though we like to think, because of all this technology we've got and advances in farming, actually we're just, as they say, 9 meals away from anarchy, you know, all the time. And I suppose one of the marvellous things actually was, I can't believe how much sort of really recent history you'd got managed to pack into the book. So talking about the COVID epidemic and, you know, a lot of the conversation we have now about ultra-processed food. You must have been typing that literally as you were about to post off the manuscript, because everything's so prescient.
More or less, yes, more or less. Yeah, so it was extraordinary to me how many resonances there were with, you know, with what kind of what's going on historically. And of course there are, but I mean, what was extraordinary was that things that we think we should have left behind in kind of Dickens's London, you know, kids going without food, mums skipping meals so that they can feed their kids, food that's essentially adulterated and poisoning us, all that stuff that we had in kind of Victorian cities are problems today. And that I found really extraordinary. One of the things that was interesting was that even as I started writing it, I felt that our attitudes to things like ultra-processed food were really beginning to shift as I got to the end of the book. And I read Chris Van Tulleken's book on ultra-processed people, and it gave me such hope. I started off my book feeling, when I'm writing my book, feeling that, you know, it was really difficult to write about these problems with food going wrong, because the kind of the dominant discussion was that everybody had personal responsibility, that, you know, parents had to take responsibility for their children. And if their food was rubbish, if their diet was rubbish, it was basically their fault. And that was quite a difficult place to kind of escape from. And I felt that things like, I mean, obviously, you know, Marcus Rashford really challenged that, but I felt that Chris Van Tulleken's book and Henry Dombey's book and, you know, work by kind of B. Wilson and lots of writers had really kind of shifted that dial to making us really understand that that concept of choice was really two things: hijacked by sort of chemically, you know, by ultra processed food, but also was so much part of a kind of our kind of social and economic and historical background. And so in a funny kind of way, I did a talk with Chris Van Tulleken recently, and we both agreed that my book was the sort of the history to his. So he explains what's happening now, and I'm trying to give some history to kind of how we get ourselves into this ridiculous situation where a lot of people are buying food that is not really food.
Well, can we just have a talk about the sort of the sort of scene setting, the initial chapters of the book? Because you talk about a long period of time before enclosures and during enclosures, and a sort of post enclosure period. What are these enclosures that you refer to?
Well, thank you for that question, because actually the enclosures were really the starting point for the book for me. I just remember walking with some friends through Suffolk, actually, and we were just talking about how different the land looked because it had been enclosed. And what that means is that before, well, the first Enclosure Act was 1604 in Radipole in Dorset, but enclosures had been going on before then. We talk about the Enclosure Acts, but there were hundreds of them, and they lasted from between, I think, 1604 to about 1920 or something. That, you know, that was the latest one. They went on for 300 years or so. And what that meant was that land that had been farmed or kind of used in common, so not necessarily owned in common. So I think this is a common misconception, is that people think that the commons, as we called them, were owned in common by villagers or by commoners. And that's usually not right. Usually what it means is that somebody owns the land. It might be the king or the, you know, a kind of lord or an aristocrat, often the church, in fact. But people have rights of common, and rights of common mean you have the rights to graze your sheep or your cattle or your geese. I talk quite a lot about geese in the book. Mm-hmm. and you turn kind of scrubland, common land, which we still know and love today, you know, Wimbledon Common and Clapham Common and all the commons that we have still, thank goodness, in our cities. Mm-hmm. You turn that into protein for your family. And what happened is that the people who actually did own the land technically started saying, well, I'm really sorry, but I'm going to chuck you off. You're going to lose all your rights of common, and I'm going to enclose it. I'm going to put hedges up. I'm going to put fences up, and I'm just going to put sheep or cattle on this land because I'll get more money out of it. And, you know, there were all kinds of economic arguments about how the country needed to be more productive. We needed to kind of produce more food and feed more people. And so the enclosures, very sorry about the individual kind of tragedies, but the country needed it. And that was the sort of driving idea behind it. But it would be devastating for people who had relied on the commons to graze their cattle or their sheep or their pigs, you know, their pigs in woodland or something. And it still happens, you know, there are still, some people still have rights of commons. We still have upland common, mm-hmm. commons in Wales, in Cumbria, where people, you know, kind of just graze their sheep.
Yes, but no longer are your geese and your pigs snuffling around in the forest and...
No, I think there are in Hampshire. I think Hampshire has a few. Okay. Still, people have kind of what's called panage, rights of panage, which is a very old medieval right to let your pigs rootle around and, you know, snuffle up acorns and things. So, yeah, so it was a massive change, both in terms of economic terms for individuals. And, of course, this is what led to so many people leaving the countryside, stopping being farmers and going to the city and becoming industrial workers. And so this kind of fueled our kind of industrial revolution. But it made a massive change to all kinds of things. It makes a massive change to those individuals, their lives, makes a massive change to the sense of us as a sort of agricultural country. We're just not any longer, you know, we stop producing food ourselves, and this kind of dislocation that we're so conscious of today between people and how food is produced, that's where it sort of is rooted from. But it also, and this is something that's not talked about so much, but I find really fascinating, it changed our sense of rights and ownership. So this idea that you so often come across is that the commons used to belong to everybody in common and that they were stolen from the people is wrong. But what I find so interesting about that is that it's based on an assumption that only ownership counts. And that's, you know, an assumption that I think that's grown out of the enclosures, that ownership is the thing that you all need to have, whereas pre-enclosure sort of relationships between people were not really based as much on ownership as they were on a series of quite complicated sort of established, you know, reciprocal rights and responsibilities and all the rest of it. And I'm not trying to kind of propose a sort of feudal or medieval or kind of Tudor sense of kind of, you know, the lord and the hierarchy. But it is quite noticeable that we think that ownership now is the be all and end all, rather than the idea that we can all share something and we all have some rights to it, but therefore we also have some responsibilities to it as well. Because I think that's the kind of major sort of social ideological change, really.
And some people flag that as a point in which maybe more English than the rest of the British Isles, maybe, although I might be wrong, really sort of began to lose their sort of high opinion of peasant dishes, is what I've heard in the past. You know, in France, it was carried on. People were able to keep their own livestock, even if it was just a goose and a pig, and that was it. And they could really take care and nurture those animals, maybe grow some herbs and things like that. But in Britain, or in England rather, that was all just sort of swept aside and really deteriorated our relationship with, you know, the food of poor people being bad food.
Yes. I think you're absolutely right. And you know this from all your kind of adventures with, you know, Jane Grigson and English food and all the work that you've done on English food, is that this idea that we don't have a peasant cuisine is nonsense. Absolute we have nonsense. we have a huge amount of traditional food, and some of which we've lost. I mean, one of the chapters I look at in the book is about oat. I love oats. I'm always cooking with oats.
But no, it's about too.
Oat, well, you're a northerner, so of course you do. You know, it is about, you know, those kind of oatmeal pancakes that are called haver cakes in you're in Lancashire. Are you in Lancashire at the moment? You're in Manchester? I mean,
yes, but I'm from Yorkshire.
Yeah. So haver cakes were this sort of old, very quite specific kind of Lancashire, Yorkshire way of kind of making oatmeal pancakes, weren't they? Mm. And what's fascinating about them is that they were completely the bread and butter, as it were, a lot of kind of villagers and a lot of people's lives and diets. And yet no recipes survive as far as we can tell. There's no, there are descriptions of them being made, but nobody says, oh, you take a bit of oatmeal, some water, some yeast, this is what you do. And we've probably both had adventures in haver cakes trying to make them. And I did actually in the end put, I had a lovely day with my sister making haver cakes, inverted commas, which were really just oatmeal pancakes that we had with sure. butter and honey. They were completely delicious. So I put a kind of a sort of version of them, a recipe in my book. But yes, I think you're absolutely right. This idea that we don't have a peasant cuisine, inverted commas, is because we've sort of, not because we don't have it, but because we've turned our back on it. But I also think that that's why it's so easy for us as a whole population to take on new foods when they're kind of produced in a factory or a kind of some kind of industry. Sugar, you know, we took to sugar very, very readily in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. Tea, obviously. Mm-hmm. So we're actually very absorptive as a culture. And in some ways, that's very good. You know, it means we've kind of, you know, we readily embrace things like curry and from the 18th century onwards mm-hmm. and recently Chinese food. And we have all kinds of exciting international foods that we love eating. But it also means that we very readily embrace, you know, industrial food. That probably is not such a great idea.
No, indeed. Certainly when I was going getting into cooking English food, when it was purely just a hobby, what really opened my eyes was, I think I had those prejudices. I think that's why I hadn't bothered cooking British food, because I just thought, well, you know.
Why would you?
Italy and Thailand, that's just so more exciting. And they have all these old peasant food recipes and things. Yeah. So, yeah, I was completely wrong. And that's why I got into it, because I realised how wrong I was. And having a go at making things like haver cakes, I mean, I'm not going to say I was particularly successful. But what I did learn was things like, they were all sourdoughs. It was all live,
of course,
wild
all bread with
ferments,
yeah.
which
yeah.
we think, you know, or most of us might think, is just some kind of either fad or weird Eastern European foreign food.
Or San Francisco, apparently.
Of course,
yes, America, yes.
Yeah, so it's either trendy or foreign or whatever, and people sort of distrust it, and it's like, well, why would you want to have sour food anyway?
Yeah.
You know, it turns out we're all having it, but again, this sort of, no, we want the white bread that's made in the beehive ovens with barm yeast or whatever, because that's what the lords and the ladies and the kings are having. We want that. We want the so-called refined food.
You know? Yes, I mean, it's very understandable that people want it. I mean, if you could just think about pre-NHS dentistry, chewing a kind of very, very gritty sourdough loaf might have been quite hard, you know, if your teeth aren't great, although having you probably pre-sugar as well, so or kind of pre as much sugar as we have now, so that might actually be in favour of your teeth health. But also, you know, you get quicker energy spikes, don't you, from kind of very refined white flour, and that's what we're all chasing.
Yeah, where my little restaurant was open for those couple of years, black coffee and donuts are being shoveled down because
exactly.
It's like I don't want to be perked up in 2 hours' time. I've got to be perked up now.
Now.
So you know, certainly have seen both sides of things. It's very nice, I must say, to be. You know, out of the restaurant. I mean, I do miss it sometimes, but it's very nice not to be shoveling down the Krispy Kremes and all that nonsense. I kind of liked the chapter that you had on allotments, because that was a bit of an attempt to get some of that common land back to the people. And I used to have an allotment, which I guess is why it stood out for me.
What did you grow?
A lot of standards, really, because they were revelations. So parsnips, broad beans, being able to have broad beans, you know, eat the whole thing on the pod, you know, the very young ones, which you, you never see. Just get the chance to eat the kind of foods. A freshly dug up potato was a wonderful thing. You know, simple pleasures. I was talking to Emma Kay ages ago now, because she did a book on herbalism, and she grew her own parsnips and I grew my own parsnips. And we were saying how you can see how they were used medicinally, because you eat a raw parsnip that you just picked up, your mouth goes numb. There's
how fascinating.
There's something in there, I don't know, that's some kind of narcotic.
Oh, wow.
Which you don't get from a supermarket parsnip.
From an old parsnip. How fascinating.
And I'm sure a wild parsnip would possibly be even stronger and numb your mouth even more. So just getting to experience food as it was when, you know, we were growing our own food. Just get that little taste of what things were like. So I wasn't doing anything, I wasn't growing angelica or sea beets or cardoons or anything. It was all just all your basics. And I just found them a revelation, almost every single one.
Yeah, fascinating. It was great that you could get an allotment, to be honest, because I think, you know, they've come back into our lives in a really big way, whereas I think there was a sort of slump, wasn't there, in the kind of 70s and 60s, 70s, 80s. They were seen as a bit kind of old mannish, and we are kind of rediscovering them. But they do have a really interesting history, because during that time of the enclosures that, you know, we were talking about, there was a big debate going on in Britain then, as you'd expect, as there should have been, about, you know, is this really the right thing to do, given that it's going to be so kind of devastating for some people. And one of the people that I found really quite sympathetic was, which I hadn't expected to, was Arthur Young. And Arthur Young was sort of secretary of the first agricultural kind of institute. And he has these extraordinary surveys. He goes all the way around the country and does these very, very kind of detailed surveys of, you know, Yorkshire or the East Anglia about kind of what people are growing and what they're producing. And he was very much in favour of, as everybody was at the time, using what was considered wasteland and turning it into farmland. And that was a massive call, because this idea was that we had this hugely growing population. We had a population that was, which kind of doubled within a century. And it was quite scary for people to see that, you know, in a way that some people in Britain now are scared about the idea of immigrants coming in. That fear was kind of implicit in the 18th and 19th century. And the immigrants were considered to be from the countryside to the town, or it was a kind of internal, it was the same problem, but it was an internal problem coming from an internal place. So people said, like, we've got to kind of turn all this wasteland that's not being used, we've got to turn it into good agricultural land, we've got to enclose it, we've got to make it more efficient. And so that's what Arthur Young thought. But he, at the same time, he said, but, you know, this is going to ruin some people. It's going to ruin their whole system of domestic economy. We should give them something else to kind of compensate. And the discussion was between people like him, and there was a movement called 3 acres and a cow movement, meaning that's what people should be given, enough land so they could graze a cow. And often the farmers, who did not want their workers to be self-sufficient, because what farmers wanted and what the, you know, employers and industrialists wanted was a lean and hungry workforce who would work for really low wages. And if they were well supplied with their own food, why would they go and work for low wages on the farm? And exactly the same thing happened in Scotland with the clearances. You know, people were pushed off to the margins, and then this whole kind of crofting system gets set up in Scotland. So crofting is not ancient. It comes from the clearances, and people, and crofts were deliberately designed to be big enough for people to be semi-sufficient, but not wholly self-sufficient. So it's designed to get people from kind of self-sufficient economy into a cash economy. People have to go to work in Scotland in the fisheries, or picking seaweed for fertilizer or whatever. In England, they had to go to work either as kind of agricultural labourers for not very much money, or to the cities in factories. And so it wasn't in the interest of the sort of commercial band of society, really, for people to be self-sufficient. And so they weren't. So we don't have in Britain any longer the idea that you sometimes still have, you know, in other parts of Europe, that you might have a small holding and your small holding, you might have, you might grow a lot of your own vegetables and fruit, and you might have a few kind of pigs, cows, sheep or whatever. That just doesn't happen in Britain any longer. And that's when it kind of disappeared.
No, indeed.
The allotment. Yeah. So the allotment was like the it was deliberately designed to be big enough just to kind of supplement the diet, keep people from starvation, but not allow them to feed themselves wholly.
One great thing about having an allotment is the sharing that goes on between other allotment owners. You know, you if you did have a glut. I mean, the planning of an allotment is so hard. You know, having food, you know, for as long as possible throughout the year. And I was particularly bad at that. So I would have 10 kilos of broad beans in a week and then none for the rest of the year. But the great thing is, of course, there's the system of trade and exchange within there. And there is something very satisfying about taking money out of the equation completely.
That's interesting. Yes. Because it never used to be in the equation. We used to get together and eat without it, presumably, to a degree.
And you could just see how all the allotmenteers, you know, really were a real community who did look out for each other. And so I do feel there's a glimmer, only a glimmer, of comparison that you can maybe make to all those centuries back, where, you know, that the community was so close-knit, people were looking out for each other. And like you say, when governments come in, now if the government is just, you know, a burgess looking after a couple of dozen people, you can see that's fine. But as that head, that government gets larger and larger and moves further and further away, they suddenly can say, well, actually, it's not up to us to make sure you've got good food. And you're like, well, no, hang on a minute, rewind. But because there's such a distance, I feel like governments can just go, oh, it's got nothing to do with us.
But the things that are historically the things that have suddenly made the governments realise that it does have something to do with them is often economic and strategic in the sense of defence and safety. So in the past, governments have realised that if you're taking an economic hit because your food is bad, you know, and I think this is probably where we were in the middle of the 19th century, because people were eating, this is in the adulteration crisis, when people were eating such, it was almost impossible to buy food in cities that wasn't adulterated, meaning it wasn't either kind of bulked out with something else. So flour would be bulked out with alum, or vinegar would be bulked out with kind of water and sulfuric acid to give it a nice little tingle. and so, you know, and eventually the government kind of moved to bring in some sort of legislation because of it was partly because of its recognition that it was kind of economically a bad idea to have people being essentially poisoned, but also there was a kind of morality to it. And then the other thing that makes governments sit up and take notice is when we're on a war footing. And this is probably something that governments should be thinking about at the moment. Everybody's panicking at the moment because apparently our army isn't big enough. And that's so similar to in 1902, 3 and 4, when we were in the Second Boer War. And everybody was panicking because our army wasn't big enough, because the people who were trying to enlist were too unhealthy. And there was a commission that looked into why this was. And lo and behold, they discovered that working class kids were unhealthy, and they had rickets and they had dental caries and they had, you know, huge problems, and they were underweight because they weren't being fed well enough. And it was a great scandal, and everybody was really worried that we weren't going to be, you know, we weren't going to be kind of militarily secure because these kids couldn't fight for us. And obviously now the idea of feeding young men up to go off and join the army and fight, you know, there's a kind of moral question in that. But at the same time, it is the government's job to make sure that we are secure as a nation. And if our young people are too ill to fight for us, then they've got to do something about it. And that's why, so going back to this idea of in the sort of beginning of the 20th century, actually, that's why they started to kind of say, well, maybe we should be giving our kids school dinners. And maybe, because school dinners before then were technically illegal under some kind of weird kind of poor law act. Yeah, very odd, isn't it? And charities in the north, particularly Yorkshire, Bradford, Lancashire, Manchester, charities were giving people school dinners, but actually it took some people in Bradford to go, right, it doesn't matter if it's illegal, we're just going to feed these kids. Mm. We're going to give them school dinners and see if they get more healthy. And lo and behold, they said, look, we've given them some really nice food and they've eaten it. And we've explained to them, you sit down and you sit around the table and you have a little pot plant in the middle of the table, mm-hmm. and you have a nice room and, you know, and everybody sits together. Like you're talking about the joy of kind of being allotmenteers together. These young kids were sort of taught the joy of sitting down together and eating together. The experiments are really interesting because the head of domestic subjects, Miss Cuff, who is my sort of my heroine, really, she brought up this sort of menu of quite low cost, quite sort of solid, you know, very kind of, you know, Edwardian food, Scotch barley broth, rhubarb tart, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Rhubarb, obviously, because it's a Yorkshire thing.
Indeed.
And she said they had a rule that the kids could refuse something, but only if they'd eaten it. Only if they tried it. Mm. And I thought that was interesting. But her secret weapon seemed to be love and time, love and patience. That seemed to be the way that she got round all these kinds of objections. You know, they gave the kids porridge for breakfast. They said that at first only one Scottish child had heard of it and they all went, ugh! And they all tried it. And then the next day, you know, some kids didn't like it, but more of them ate it. And then by the third day, she said they all ate it and they all loved it. And it's rather sweet. She said, we were going to kind of vary the breakfast menu, but the kids loved their porridge so much, we just gave it to them every day. Because she made it well, you know, she made sure it was made well. And poor old porridge, you know, it gets a terrible rap because it was made badly. And, you know, if you make porridge in a very, very thin saucepan, which is probably what most people have, it burns so easily, it catches really easily, and burnt porridge is hideous. And obviously, if you can serve it with cream or jam or golden syrup or something, it's obviously going to be more acceptable.
I really like the sharing section of the book. Sharing of food, or sometimes the abstaining of food together, was a really interesting angle. I'd not thought about it in those terms before. It's still about food, even though there's no food there or not as much food there. I was very pleased to see in that section of the book, Hannah Woolley's pumpkin pie.
Yes. She's great, isn't she?
She is.
Slightly crazy, maybe.
Well, maybe. Well, actually,
as we know who she is, even. Yes.
Indeed. Well, for those who don't know or haven't heard the name Hannah Woolley, can you just briefly tell us about her and her book?
Hannah Woolley was definitely a person. She was writing in the mid-17th century and she wrote books telling people how to behave, how kind of young women should behave, and of course in the sort of society, but in the kind of domestic situation. And of course part of that behavior was how to cook. And she's quite interesting because she's one of the first people who has published a cookbook or something similar to a cookbook with a woman's name as the kind of the USP, the kind of marketing thing. And we don't really know whether it was her or whether it was an editor, a male or female editor, kind of publishing under her name in all her books. But definitely she was a woman writing at this particular time. And it's quite interesting if you compare it to France, for example, where there was no cookbooks written by women for, I think, until, I can't remember the exact date, I think in the 19th century, so quite a lot later. And so in Britain, you had this idea emerging very early on that there were female experts in domestic subjects, including cooking.
Yes.
And they were quite different from the chefs, who were nearly always male and often French. And so our other Hannah Glass, who many people have heard of a century later, fits into that realm. And of course, then Eliza Acton and Mrs. Beaton and all the rest of it. And so it's quite a sort of British idea, this kind of pragmatic, economic, this female voice telling you how to run your family, how to run your kitchen, and also here are some recipes. And often the recipes are amazing. Often the recipes are great. And I think we've both cooked her pumpkin pie.
That's right.
Which she has a couple of recipes for pumpkin pie, slightly eccentric, some of them in our own, you know, maybe to us, slightly over complicated. But she has essentially, I think, the things that she gets right in her pumpkin pie. She puts apple in it, so it gives it a bit of tang. Yep. And she puts a tiny bit of black pepper in as well. And I think that really also helps. It gives us a bit of kind of depth. But it's a great recipe.
It's a great recipe. There's a very unusual froise element.
Yes, whatever that is.
A sweet pancake. Yeah, with things like marjoram and, you know, things that we wouldn't herbs, consider sweet at all. Yeah, I thought I'll have a go at that because it was the first, as far as I know, it's the first pancake. It's the first pumpkin pie recipe. It's based on a recipe by somebody, WM, he's called, I think, that's about five or six years older, but it's basically the same recipe.
Yeah.
So I just thought, well, that's good. I was cooking a meal for Halloween, so I thought, well, it's going to be done.
Yes.
And I was thinking, this is going to be awful. It's going to be this pancake. It's going to be this omelette, sweet omelette with herbs in it. That's going to be, it's cooked all the way through. Then it's cooked again in the oven with the apples and whatnot. Then you have the, what's it called? The you pour in your caudle in the top.
A sweet caudle.
And I just thought, this is going to be an absolute disaster. And it is one of the most delicious things I've ever eaten. So when I got to the chapter on pumpkin pie and I saw that you'd written about it, I just thought, oh, fantastic. Yeah. Somebody else has had a go.
The recipe I adapt is actually not the very complicated one that you did. It's a slightly simpler one. I don't do the frozz thing on the top. I just do the pumpkin and the apple and a few herbs.
Well, I really like those recipes that you've updated really for modern kitchens, rather than just trying to reproduce an old recipe. You know, it's not conducive really to modern technology.
You want people to like them, don't you?
you want people to have a go.
You want people to eat them. Actually, this tastes quite nice.
Yeah, so it's a fine line, but I'm sure you've obviously cooked a lot of historical recipes, and sometimes it's not the actual final product. It's a flavour combination that we've lost, like the black pepper and apples that you take through into your cooking. And I always put black pepper in my apple pies. I always put nutmeg in my mashed potatoes. All these things that I didn't know about.
Those very Georgian tastes,
My other favourite thing is, which I put in everything now, is orange flower water.
Oh, that's very Georgian. Yeah, that's very Jane Austen. Yeah.
Very Jane Austen, Well, hey, we're going to have to wrap up, I think, Pem. We've got stuff to do. Yeah, so thanks again for coming on. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Oh, and to you as well.
Got any events or anything, or any new projects or things coming out that people might...
Yes, what am I doing? I'm a few things. I'm going to Oxford for their literary festival. I'm going to Hexham in Northumberland to their literary festival. Hannah Glass Country, exactly. Yes, I'll be going to Hay for the Hay Literary Festival. That's all I can remember for now, I think. But yes, a few things.
That's great. I'll put links to those things in the show notes for people so they can check it out.
Thank you.
Well, yes, so thanks again. And well, hopefully I have the chance to chat to you again in the future.
Thanks, Neil. Bye.
Thank you very much, Pen. I have left links in the show notes regarding Pen's excellent book, Stuffed, those festivals that she will be appearing at, as well as her social media. Also in the show notes are links to Chris Van Tulleken's book, Ultra Processed People, That Pumpkin Pie Recipe, and to previous episodes of the podcast pertinent to today's episode, The School Meal Service with Heather Ellis, A History of Herbalism with Emma Kay, and English Food, A People's History with Diane Perkis. Okay, Easter eggs for subscribers. It being Easter, they are particularly delicious eggs today, and there are three of them. One is more about food, nutrition, and responsibility. There's quite a long one which covers quite a lot of ground. The uncut part of our discussion about school dinners, which led on to a discussion of traditional cookery and why the British have never really been a fish-eating nation. And there's a very little sort of outtake, I suppose, all about cabbage water. So I hope you enjoy those. If you'd like to become a £3 monthly subscriber and access the Easter eggs, there's quite a lot of Easter eggs now, plus there's extra blog posts and a monthly newsletter. So if you'd like to join, please visit the website britishfoodhistory.com, go to the support the blog and podcast tab. You can also gift me, if you like, with a one-off virtual coffee or virtual pint, and everything I receive goes back into making more content. Now, I know I say this kind of thing a lot, but another huge thank you to everyone for listening, downloading, and telling other people. Whatever you're doing, it's really working. The podcast is continuing to grow and grow at a rate much quicker than I ever expected. There's lots of new folk that are finding it. I'm very grateful. But if you haven't, please leave a rating or a review or follow the podcast on whatever podcast app you prefer, which will get us further up the charts so that even more people find out about it. Right, some quick other news. I popped up on not one, but two podcasts recently. I was on the plant-based podcast talking fruit and veg growing and the history of sugar. And I popped up on Your Last Meal talking about the tradition of the Sunday roast. Links in the show notes to those as well, of course. Remember, if this episode has fired off any thoughts, comments, questions, please let me know. We're over halfway through the season, so I'm going to start compiling things to be going in the postbag edition pretty soon. I'll be back very soon with another episode, but until then, have a fantastic Easter. Cheerio.